Good morning.
Good morning, Hugh. Could you start by telling me, please, your full name, your date of birth, and where you were born, please?
Allen, A-L-L-E-N, Hugh Stevenson, with a P-H. Date of birth, 5 June 1936. A very good year, I might add. And we were born, my brother and I were born in Kegworth, Leicestershire, which is very close to East Midlands Airport, if you don't know it, and now subject to flooding because of this graceful, what do you call it, they put a big road across the River Soar some years ago and didn't bother to make any facility for letting the water get away, the flood water, and they only put it across the bridge. So, of course, it all backs up now.
Oh, dear.
It's far worse than ever it was.
Mm.
Anyway, that's where we lived, and we should never have been at the Blue Coat. It was a tissue of lies concocted by my uncle, who was a private detective in, I think he's had an office on Hope Street in Liverpool.
Oh, right. So tell me a little bit about your early life then and your family and how you did end up at the Blue Coat then.
Well, my father was much older than my mother. He'd served right through the First World War.
Wow.
Mainly as a machine gunner. And he, I had an uncle who was killed at Gallipoli. It goes back a bit, doesn't it?
Wow.
My mother was his second wife, his first wife, having produced two children when they were about eight, well, very early on indeed, in fact, something like 8 and 10, she deserted them.
Mm.
She's a strange woman, and she cleared off, married again, had another child, deserted them.
Oh,
oh dear. Oh. But anyway, that was nothing to do with us. So we were living in the Midland because my father was the Midland manager of a firm called Grattan and Knight, and they in fact dealt in industrial belting. In those days, most of the machinery in factories was done was driven through overhead shafting and belts.
Yeah.
And that was his staple. But he also did stuff in mines, you know, conveyor melting,
right,
in,
yeah,
mines and so on. That sort of thing, anyway. And so that's why we were living in Leicestershire, because he was the Midland manager. Well, he got brain cancer in 1943, and he didn't have he was too heavy for his height, so he had no insurance, and so it looked rather difficult. Anyway, my uncle, that was my mother's sister's husband, who was the first person, the youngest person ever to win an MC in the First World War.
Wow.
Could you believe it? Anyway, when the school was evacuated to Beaumaris, the Ministry of Missing Persons took over the school building. And being a private detective, he was working with them, looking, finding missing persons, and knew about the school, and being a bit of a networker, he wrote a letter to the school with the tissue of lies about how normally we lived with them in Halewood, which we damn well didn't. But he was also a networker, and he knew the previous chairman of the Board of Governors,
yeah,
you know, the treasurer. Mm. So, and he got him to countersign the letter. So that made it more or less a given, you see.
Yeah.
And I know the only person who was suspicious was Dr. Dickerson. And my mother had been briefed very carefully to say what to say to him, or
yeah,
anybody else who asked awkward questions. So we were entered as foundationers in February 1944.
Wow.
So did this mean that you went to Beaumaris, or was by that time the school back in Liverpool?
You haven't read my book, have you?
Not all of it, no.
In fact, it's all in there. But anyway, we ended up with 2.5 years in Beaumaris. We didn't leave Beaumaris until Easter 1946.
And what was life like in Beaumaris?
Well, it was very much freer than it was in Wavertree.
I can imagine.
The earlier book, some of the one or other, I've certainly read another account, you know, when the school turned up there, there were no real facilities. Everybody was boarded out.
Yes.
I think the school originally started off at the grammar school in Beaumaris, and then goodness knows how that was managed, and then it moved to Bryn, the private house, and that's where the school was run. But the it was basically, there was not very much discipline at all, really. I think Watkin, who was the senior master, had a bit of a problem keeping tabs on things. They had the Woodgarth, of course, and Red Hill House was the dower house for the Williams Buckleys. You knew that, did you?
Yes, I've heard that.
Sir Richard Williams Buckley was the big landowner there.
That's right.
Funnily enough, much later on, when I joined the Naval Reserve, it turned out that one of them had actually founded the Liverpool Division of the Royal Naval Reserve.
Really?
Quite interesting, really. But anyway, that's just an aside. So we were at the Woodgarth for the first term, and then Mrs. Hay. Graham Hay was with us. He joined at the same time. I'm still in touch with him. And we were at Woodgarth, and then Mrs. Hay, who was divorced from her husband, took a job as matron, a girl's matron, and persuaded the school to that the very young boys, and what we were about only about seven, six and seven, go and live up with the girls in the girls' hospital, and that's what we did for the rest of our time in Beaumaris.
So did you actually learn very much, or were you busy just running around the woods and fields in the town?
No. There were proper classes and so on.
There were.
You know, it was a standard routine.
Yeah.
But this was, of course, in 1905. I think initially it was a bit... Well, I'm not quite sure. Initially, I think the boys... Boys and girls were tied, certainly tied up, the boys are tied up at the grammar school, I think. But very soon after that, the school got itself organized at Bryn.
Yeah.
And it was a standard. I can remember the first going there, we were in the first Form 1 with Miss Hipkiss, Ma Hipkiss. And she would come marching in, everybody stood up. And we'd rattle off the Ten Commandments,
yeah.
or some of the tables, you know, the ten yeah. times tables, that sort of thing. But there were, you know, the desk. There were no proper books or anything like that. I can't remember doing very much about that.
Right.
It was all a bit sort of basic Victorian sort of. Teaching and opinion. I can remember doing. We had music lessons and so on.
Yeah.
But that is, you know, singing lessons. Singing was very important. The school originally had attended the local church.
Yeah.
The parish church, but then when it got its little chapel, everybody spent their time there, and we had a local organist come choir master, who taught singing and. Every now and again, Dr. Dickerson would come up and terrify everybody. He was a very Victorian. I got on quite well with him, actually. It turned out that he came from Leicester.
Yeah.
And since we were Leicestershire people, you know, he felt that we'd got a little bit of affinity.
Yeah, yeah. So did you enjoy it? Was it a good time?
Well, I mean, we didn't have anything to compare it with.
Yeah.
Not really. I can remember we'd get sixpence a week, and we'd decide whether we were going to spend it on Vaseline to keep what we had left of our hair tucked down.
we'd
buy Lingfo Fizz. It was a funny little sort of powder, and you could stick your finger in it and then suck it in. It was a bit like a cordial,
yeah,
when
yeah.
you sucked it.
So,
and then we used to go to the when the senior boys that played sport on a Saturday, but we used to go to the local cinema.
Mm-hmm.
The very young ones.
Yeah. So so then you came back to Wavertree, so that must have been another cultural shock for you.
Well, it certainly bloody well was, I'll tell you. I mean, it was like being in prison. We weren't allowed out.
Yeah.
There was an opportunity then to... Of course, the schooling became a bit more regular then.
Yeah.
But the school was very short of teachers. I mean, in Morris, it was very short of teachers. Woodward was taught by the local undertaker who made coffins and things. And the second form was taught by Ma Spargo, Mrs. Spargo. My brother visited her many years later when he was stationed at Valley in Anglesey.
Yeah.
And I had a chat. Of course, there'd been a certain amount of development, not a huge amount of development. And on one occasion, the school went back to, I can remember when, just before we left with an outing to Beaumaris. It was interesting going back to see what it was like.
Yeah.
But anyway, but the schooling was, as I say, I suppose, you know, when we were at Beaumaris, we had two teachers, Miss Hipkiss, Ma Hipkiss, and for the first year, and then Ma Spargo for the second, and then we left. Mrs. Spargo, she'd say, we're going to have scrapbooks of film stars. She used to call them film stars. And she'd turn up with cutting with photographs cut out of the Radio Times. But it was and all the girls, there were nine girls in that class, and they all came one to nine in the exams. Ha ha.
did you?
And I can remember then. The headmaster at the time was R. Bruce Wilson, but he retired. He was a reverend,
yeah.
And he retired after the first year, and a bloke called Heritage, the Reverend Heritage, who had been a canon in Portsmouth, I think, and he came up, and I didn't like him very much at all. I can remember him threatening me with the cane for something that I had no idea I'd done.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed to be that the idea was that people should be terrified.
Yes.
And of course, corporal punishment was absolutely common, and it went on right through, until towards the end.
Yeah. I think, it went right the way through until almost the 70s.
Well, that's right, yes. I mean, the standard practice, all the miscreants, after assembly, they would wait outside the little study underneath the organ, and get the whack.
Yeah. So, what was life back in Wavertree then? As you say, it was more rigorous.
The thing was, when we were in Beaumaris, you could get out and move around without too much restriction. I mean, the things to do.
Yeah.
We used to play rounders when we were at Red Hill. When you got back to Liverpool, there was no proper. I noticed in your suggestion what sort of extramural activities, or most of the things, were done on our own initiative.
Yeah.
I can remember though. It must have been just after the school, after the girls left, and there was a Mr. Fisher there who started a photographic club.
Yeah.
And that was quite interesting. And then there was the scouts, of course, and that went on for as long as I was there, actually.
Yeah.
And there was the 31st Wavertree, it was called, and that was run sometimes by people from outside, and sometimes by Mr. Jackson, who was the art teacher. He left to get married, actually, but he also taught art, and he didn't have a clue. And he was replaced by Douglas Garland, who was much more inspirational and a proper teacher of art.
Yeah.
Knew what he was doing and instilled in me the love of impressionism.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Still like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was quite a change. Mm. I mean, Mr. Jackson's idea of art was to take a piece of half imperial, divide it up into squares, 2.5 inches by 2.5 inches, put a design in one, and then repeat it in the rest of them. Unutterably boring. Incredible.
Yeah.
Really, when you think about it.
Yeah.
So
I mean, the Aero Club was started by my brother and I.
Okay.
We were interested in when we went away to school initially. My mother took in students from Loughborough College in order to make ends meet. And at her, and when we got home, there was a chap there. And I can remember his name, John Buttrell. He made gliders, you know, balsa wood gliders, and that really started the interest.
Mm.
And I continued doing that until almost when I left.
Mm. Yeah. So
various types of aircraft.
You talked about the girls leaving the school because in 1949 the school went boys only. Was that
that's when the standard in the dining room went down with a crash.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
But I was going to ask, was there...
It was almost butter on the ceiling type fun, you know?
Had there been any interaction with the girls' school, or were they run as two?
No, none at all. No, that was one of the big disadvantages. I mean, it was a big loss for us, because it was a quasi-normal... And then suddenly we found ourselves in a male environment and completely separated from the opposite sex.
Mm. Mm. Well, what about your friendship group, Hugh? Did you have a lot of camaraderie with your friends, or were you more of a...
Well, I don't know what you mean by that, myself. Actually, I mean, we got on well with people. Obviously, we were forced to.
Mm. Mm. I suppose it's just some people say, because, you know, when you're boarders and you're kind of living with people that, you know, a lot of it, sort of friends really, you know, got them through. They had lots of laughs and things like that.
There were the well-known comedians. I got to appreciate the Liverpudlian sense of humour.
Mm.
Yeah.
There was a bloke we had in our class called Joker Kane. Very, very dry sense of humour. It was quite delightful, really.
Have you got any examples of some of this humour or these laughs you had?
Yeah, he was asked how many children he thought he might have. He said, I have a lazy eight. A lazy eight is an infinity sign.
Yeah.
I can never forget that.
So, carry on, sorry.
Well, then, but the interesting thing, I mean, if you're talking about teaching, I mean, I had 13 math teachers in 11 years.
Wow.
And bear in mind, we were in that school for 11 years. I don't think anybody will ever break that record.
No.
Not really.
Do you feel you had a good education?
Well, it was, I don't know whether it was a good education or not. It got very much better, but at the age of 13, when the boys were being divided into, or decided whether they should go into the grammar school or the modern, my brother, on the basis of, I think it was just a single intelligence test, my brother was to go into the grammar school and I was to go into the secondary modern.
Yeah.
And my mother kicked up a fuss, but what she did on the Easter before that was likely to happen, she took us to be independently assessed by the headmaster of a local school in Haltham, which is about 3 miles out of Kegworth, and he assessed us as being between a year and 15 months behind the state equivalent.
Yeah.
Which so you may say, well, is the education, what was the education like? Well, quite frankly, on that basis, it was pretty bloody awful, wasn't it? Really, on that one basis.
Yeah, yeah.
I have no other. Luckily, I managed. I squeezed into the grammar school.
Yeah.
But I suppose that somebody who should have been in the grammar school didn't get the job because there are only so many places.
Yeah, quite. Yeah.
In fact, there was a bloke called Peter Stainer. I often wonder what happened to him because I think he was cleverer than I was. He was certainly as capable. And he didn't get in, and he should have done.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, James Hay, that I still, I mean, he's beginning to lose it now, actually. But in fact, he was an example of somebody who went through the modern school, and they came out without any objective, without any aim, really. There was no, in those days, the modern school didn't have any end purpose.
Yes.
So you didn't take any exams. You didn't prove anything much at all.
Yeah.
And it was really disgraceful. But that was what it was like in those days. I mean, you know about the tripartite system of the 1944 Education Act, I suppose.
Yes.
You do. I mean, it was grammar school or second or technical, and the people who didn't fit, the 20% who didn't fit, went into the secondary modern, and the government never put in the investment into the technical schools, so it was 25% going into the grammar school, and the rest went into secondary modern.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that kind of fueled the whole movement for the comprehensive system, didn't it?
Well, yes, I agree with you, but I still think that the second division, you know, does get a bad deal in this country.
Yeah.
That's where the effort should be.
Absolutely.
In my opinion.
To write people off at the age of 11 is terrible, isn't it?
Well, I agree. I think this. The only way there will be any improvement, if you say to the senior civil servants at the administrative class, you can't use the private school system, and then you see a change.
Aww. Indeed, yes. Well, we're wandering off blue coat, yes.
Well, what else do you want to know?
Well, could you just briefly tell us about your career after the school? Did you go through sixth form or what?
Yes, I did, but I was living in a little. I was living in a bubble. I didn't know what I was up against, you know. Looking back, because I've done some teaching, you know, the actual teaching method, you know, and the textbooks are bloody awful.
Yeah.
When you think about it, compared with what's available now.
Mm.
And anyway, I made some silly mistakes, and I didn't get a good enough series of A levels.
Yeah.
Although if I'd had a bit more advice, I think I might have been a less introspective. I think I would have done well. Anyway, so I left when I was 19. I shouldn't have stayed that long. See, after the GCE levels,
yeah.
I didn't have mathematics. I didn't do very well in that.
Yeah.
And I spent quite a lot of time on two or three of the O-level subjects, and I should have been also, because we did physics with chemistry, which is really a very poor basis for physics and chemistry, you know, as separate subjects. And the school let me waste my time, a large proportion of my time, during the year after the O-levels. I think I was very badly advised there, but of course I didn't know. I didn't realise. You know, as I say, I was living in a bit of a fool's paradise. So when I realised, you know, that I might not do all that well in A levels, I discussed it with my mother. She said, "Well, I can't afford to keep you," because she was away teaching.
Yeah.
And so I applied to the local engineering firm, Brush Electrical Engineering Company in Loughborough, only 6 miles away, which was a medium-heavy electrical plant manufacturing company.
Yes.
And they had a very good, it turned out, a very good student apprenticeship scheme. I was jolly lucky to get onto it, but, you know, that I realized that it was available.
Yeah.
And so when I left school, I went off around on that round trip to Nigeria, courtesy of Elder Dempster Lyons and Sir Alan Todd. Which you knew about, didn't you?
Yes, I'd read about that in your book.
Yes. And then I joined as a student apprentice. And I realised very quickly I'd got to pull my finger out.
Yeah.
Because they put me onto the ordinary national certificate.
Mm.
And I thought, God, what have I done? What? and we put away, and I had to attend the central training school, and it was pretty. It was very, very basic. Everybody was doing that. All the trade apprentices were doing that as well, you see.
Mm.
And there were two types of apprentice, well, three actually, in the company. There was the student apprentice, who did day release with the national certificate. There was the craft apprentice, and they were the people who were going to be the top craftsmen in the company.
Yeah.
And then there were the graduate apprentices, who had spent a year at university, and then went into the company for a year, perhaps, when they finished, and then went on to they were employed as senior staff, you see. But there was a very wide range of people there, and it was a very, very interesting time, I have to say. And I'm still in close touch with one of my friends, who I'm godfather to his daughter.
So did you spend your career in electrical engineering?
Well, what happened was, you know, I was doing a national certificate, I was asked to do a special project to do associated with the Jodrell Bank radio telescope, which we mounted, and so I was able to get a very good national certificate,
yeah.
And I got a place at I thought, well, I'm not staying here doing this flogging away and suffering burnout at the age of 30, you know, trying to get some sort of professional qualification. There are easy ways of doing it. So I got myself a place at Loughborough College, as it then was, and I got some money. I got a promise of a grant from the Leicestershire Educational Authority, and I said to the company, well, I've got the place and I've got the money and I want to go, you see. And they said we should try for our scholarship, and it was only two a year. Cut a long story short, I got that, one of those, and they sent me to the College of Advanced Technology in Birmingham, which is now Aston University. And that was 6 months on, 6 months off during the year. And that really opened my eyes quite a bit anyway. And I qualified in 1961, I think it was.
Yeah.
I went there. I joined the company in 55. I did 2 years as a student apprentice, and then I moved to onto their sandwich apprentice scheme, which is 4 years more. So I was 6 years in training there. I didn't finish until I was about 25, which is very late if you think about it. When most people, you might expect them to finish at 21, you know, go through university and come out at 21 with a qualification. But I'd had a lot of practical experience. And of course, you never know. You can't really run a control on your own life, but I think that in order to be able to design things, you've got to understand what the limitations are of the materials you're using and so on.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, it was quite useful. They had a lien on my services for 2 years after I finished. I stayed for 3.5. But my course at Aston had not, in fact, included anything like enough electronics. At one stage in my stay in the blue coat, I thought it might be a good idea to go to sea. I knew that the Conway existed because we used to see them occasionally when we were in Bermondsey. And
was the Conway ship still in the Menai Straits at that time?
Oh yes, it was. Yes, yeah. It wasn't wrecked until 1952 or 3, I think
right.
It was, when they were trying to move it, and they totally misread the. The tides and so on, and it drifted onto the rock, broke its back, and then caught fire, and that was the end of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, but my eyesight failed at the age of about 14. I suddenly became short-sighted.
Yeah.
So that ruled that out. So I had to think again. So the Navy was wanting electrical engineers in the 1960s. A friend of mine told me much later, he said, of course, when you joined the Navy was desperate for electrical engineers. I said, well, that said a great deal, don't it? But anyway, so I left in 1965 and took a short service commission with the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
So I joined as a lieutenant with 3 years in.
Yeah.
And in those days we had, or the Navy had, 150 major warships at sea.
Wow.
Most of them were very old.
Yeah.
And I found myself as the weapon engineer, senior electrical man, in a frigate for 2.5 years, following about a year at Collingwood, which was the electrical school.
Yeah.
And then in 1970, that was the end of my contract, if you like. And I came out and joined British Telecom, as it now is. And I stayed with them for 18 years.
Yeah.
I left in 1989, something like that, and did a couple of years teaching in physics with electronics,
yeah.
With technology rather, and then I took early retirement and spent most of my time doing silversmithing work.
Right.
I'd qualified using the City and Guilds and other methods up to advanced level for just about every aspect of silversmithing and jewellery.
It sounds like Blue Coat didn't do you too badly then.
Well, no. I would say probably we were thoroughly institutionalized.
Yeah.
And what it tends to do is, if you know anything at all about institutionalization, it tends to mess up your interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
The ability to, and I sometimes think if I'm looking for an excuse, that's why I never married. Because you become very, very,
self-contained?
Self-contained. Very, 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 very independently minded. You don't need anybody, you know.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
learn not to need anybody.
Yeah.
And bear in mind that both Guy and I came out of a totally different environment, the Blue Coat was, when we joined it. After it changed, of course, as the school started to take paying people and so on, and the actual hinterland for the school changed. I can remember being when the day boys came. I mean, it was a 2-1. It was a 2-1 ratio of day boys to boarders, and I can remember one of my saying, "God, I don't know how you can stand living in this situation." We had no radio. None of the things which people were normally expecting.
Yeah.
You know, if you'd lived in an ordinary home, but we didn't know any better.
Yeah.
We thought, you know, it was it never occurred to us, you know, that we were in a rather an odd situation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks very much indeed. We've got to move on to.
I don't know whether I mean, have anything else you want to know.
I think that's you've given us an awful lot there, so I think that's been very good indeed. So thanks very much indeed for all your time.
I mean, what I would say, in some end, I've talked to, things could have been a lot worse if we had not gone there, in my opinion.
Yeah,
sure. And I was talking to Graham Hay.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you've spoken to him at all.
No, not yet.
But I speak to him quite regularly.
Yes.
And he and I and think, well, it could have been a lot worse, you know. What would we have done otherwise, you
yes,
see?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, thanks very much indeed, Hugh.
Thank you.
What's going to happen next, then? What's going to be the outcome of this oral history?
Well, this will be archived now in the Blue Coat for perpetuity, really. We just keep these forever now. Obviously, with recording equipment, we can always keep on transferring these recordings. But they'll also be housed in National Museums Liverpool as well. So, yeah, so you're...
So
you're
not only have I got an ISBN number, I'm now going to be on this...
You're an old relic now.
I beg your pardon?
You're an old relic now in the museum.
An old relic?
An old relic.
you're now a historical artefact, Hugh.
I was a historical artefact.
You are.
Forever. You've now reached immortality.